May it please the court, counsel. I'm Gary Cohen, registration number 7612, on behalf of the appellant Cindy Wagner. And if the court's permission, I'm going to refer to the parties by first names as the trial court did. The three issues that were raised on appeal. The biggest issue concerns the roof on this building called River Park Plaza, which was awarded to Cindy. The testimony of both parties was that River Park Plaza needed a new roof. The trial court so found on page 19 of the permanent orders, and that's CD 252. Prior to the first day of trial, in the morning of the first day of trial, the parties submitted a stipulation to the court, and that is found at CD 136 to 139. In paragraph 10 of that stipulation, the parties stipulated that River Park Plaza and Estes Park valued at $2,280,000. The parties disagree whether pending roof and sprinkler repairs should be deducted from this value. So they did stipulate that there were pending roof repairs and sprinkler repairs. The trial court found that the roof repairs or cost of the new roof was deducted from the appraisal of Mr. Shannon, which valued the property at $2,280,000. That's false. That's an error. The sprinkler repairs were deducted, but the roof was not. And there's no evidence that it was deducted. So the issue then became, that's the first error by the trial court on that issue. The issue then became the amount that should be deducted. On April 27, 2010, 2 months before the permanent orders hearing, Cindy's trial counsel sent the copy of the bid to repair the roof from Kent Nelson to Brian's trial counsel. The amount was $132,395. In fact, after the trial, that bid was actually used and the roof was repaired. Now, this report, and Mr. Nelson was not technically disclosed with a pleading that says disclosure under Rule 26A1 or a divorce rule pursuant to discovery, but it was actually sent to Brian's counsel.
Also, before you get to, you know, whether the pleading was sufficient or wasn't, in a property division where the trial court has allocated to each party, we're not at liberty to disturb that unless there's been a clear abuse of discretion. And how can we say that there's a clear abuse of discretion when we're talking about a building that's worth upwards of $2 million and the parties are disputing less than $100,000 worth of that? Well, how is that an abuse of discretion?
They're not disputing the value of $2,280,000. They're disputing whether the roof repairs should be deducted because that impacted on the value. And what happened in this case, the court found that the roof repairs had already been deducted in determining that value, and that was just error. So
I understand your argument that, you know, there's an estimate out there about $132,000 to repair it. There's another estimate about $90,000 to repair it. Even Mr. McMahill, you know, had a lower estimate. The estimates vary, you know, maybe in the $50,000-$60,000 range. How is, you know, less than 3% of the value of that property, how is that an abuse of the trial court's discretion?
Well, the trial court divided everything on a 50-50 basis, all of the division. And by not giving Cindy credit for this $132,000, it overstated her equalization note by $66,000.
Mr. Cohen, to follow up on Judge Fox's question, in the marriage of balancing case, the Supreme Court said that if there is an error in the division of property that affects a small portion of the marital estate, then the error can be disregarded as harmless. I think that's what Judge Fox is suggesting here. Would you disagree with her characterization?
I do, Your Honor. $66,000 was not harmless to Cindy.
Well, but the total amount of the marital estate that Judge Lammons divided was over $7 million. So it was like more than $3.5 million to each party.
I understand that. But there's still an error. I think $66,000 is a substantial sum of money. And to Ms. Wagner, Cindy, it's a very substantial sum of money, and so therefore it wasn't harmless.
Now, let me ask you, counsel, how clear was it, or where would we find the expressions of how clear it is that the trial court intended a 50-50, not just an equitable distribution, but 50-50? How clear is that?
I think it's crystal clear.
And where will we find that in the record?
If you look at the adjustments, the chart when he divided the property, he did everything. He recorded values and said, okay, to equalize it, to make the values 50-50, Cindy would give an equalization note, to promissory note, to Brian. And so the court was clear, we're dividing the property and to make it equal, there's an equalization note, and this $132,000, which equates to 66 when you divide it in half, deviates from that equal division.
Mr. Cohen, you were starting to tell us about how Mr. Nelson had not been called as an expert witness. Is there any explanation in the record as to why he was not called as an expert witness?
Yes. There are two explanations. One, on June 22nd, and it's at CD page 805 to 811, it's the hearing on, or the argument on calling Mr. Nelson and using Exhibit O. And in fact, on page 809 of the CD, of the transcript, line 18 to line 20, Brian's counsel says he has not been disclosed in any way, and they've had this exhibit since March, Exhibit O, and did not disclose it. So that's what their argument was. Now later on, and this is found on the CD pages 957 to 959, Cindy's counsel marked Exhibit W, which was her letter enclosing this bid, which was Exhibit O, and disclosing Mr. Nelson to Brian's counsel on April 27th. So that's 2 months before the permanent orders hearing. So the statement by Brian's counsel is just not true.
Well, I don't think, excuse me, Mr. Cohen, for interrupting. I don't think that you've answered my question, because I was asking if there was an explanation why Mr. Nelson had not been listed as an expert witness. I know that you have mentioned in your brief, and you just told us that there was disclosure to the other side of his estimate, but is there any explanation in the record as to why he was not called, listed as an expert witness?
Yes, and this is from Cindy's counsel. This is, again, pages 957 and 959 on the CD. And she says they were communicating, she anticipated that there would be a stipulation of the value, the cost of the roof repairs. And so because there was going to be a stipulation, she did not technically or formally disclose the report.
But wasn't she taking an awfully big risk in not submitting the disclosure? I mean, you can always withdraw an expert if you're later able to reach a stipulation. And so assuming we say that, okay, there was no bad faith, it wasn't willful, but it was negligent. And if there was negligence, why should the husband have to bear the burden for that negligence instead of the wife when it was the wife's attorney who failed to timely make that disclosure?
I agree with you that Cindy's trial attorney should have made a technical disclosure. But Brian was not prejudiced, was not harmed. He had this information. He knew they were trying to stipulate. He never advised Cindy's counsel until the eve of trial that they would not stipulate. So if anyone has been prejudiced, it's Cindy, not Brian, because she was anticipating, or counsel was anticipating, that they would reach an agreement based on this.
Couldn't she cure any prejudice by just doing her expert disclosures on time and again withdrawing the expert if they later reach a stipulation?
I can't disagree with you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I would have made the disclosure, a formal disclosure, but it wasn't made, so we have to look at the circumstances as they actually exist. I'd like to reserve a little time for rebuttal, but I'd just like to say that all the factors under the Berry case, when you consider them, there was a substantial justification, and it was harmless to Brian. This matter could have been continued just on that one issue, since the permanent orders weren't issued until 2.5 months later.
Did the wife's counsel ask for a continuance of the trial?
No, she
Thank
should
you.
Have.
Thank you.
I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Certainly.
Good afternoon. Diane Lathrop for the appellee, number 16071. Counsel, may it please the court. Here, I'm first going to start out with the argument regarding Merle the horse. In the appellant's brief and reply brief, he says that there's no evidence whatsoever regarding the $40,000 as a valid value for that horse. And yet, in Ms. McMahill, Cindy's testimony on page CD page 632, lines 21 through 25, and asking if she wanted Merle, and what about Merle? Answer, Merle can go on my side for the $40,000, correct? And if he gets the insurance check, does that mean I get to keep the full insurance check? So there is evidence that the court relied on, and that was specifically her stipulation as to the value of that horse that should go on her side. Regarding the issue of the roof, I first argue that Berry does not even apply because Berry was so far before the trial date had not been set. This really was at the eve of trial. And I'd also like to point out to the court that the co-petitioner, Ms. McMahill's attorney, actually updated her witness exhibit on June 16th, which was 5 days before the trial. So not only had she had the initial disclosures, but then she had a second chance at it, to which Mr. McMahill did not object when she added additional witnesses.
Ms. Lathrop, can you address your opponent's argument that there was no prejudice to your client, given that there was a disclosure by letter, even though there was an informal pleading?
Your Honor, honestly, to this day, I can still say that there was so much pleadings and letters going back and forth that I did not see that. And she came up with a letter saying that she'd fax it to my office. There seems to be proof it was faxed to my office. But until we got the exhibit books, which was about a week in advance, about 10 days in advance, I can honestly still say that I don't remember seeing that letter. There was such amount going on. And this case was huge and actually was going back to 1982, we were proving documents and doing documents. So this was quite extensive. There were several businesses involved. So,
and had Mr. McMahill designated an expert on the roof repairs himself?
We did not.
Ms. Lathrop, is there any explanation in the record as to why Mr. McMahill apparently said that he thought that the cost of roof repairs was $40,000, or at least he said that amount had been budgeted, and yet the estimate was a great deal more than that?
Yes, John, I believe that this is something that they had looked at over time, that they were going to have to at some point. This was a very old building. They'd never done any maintenance to it. They'd had some leaks. I think one of the tenants testified as to that. And so at some point, they had looked at what it was going to cost to repair or do it. And so in his mind, he had come up with about a $40,000 figure.
So would $40,000 be accurate to attribute to him for the value of the roof repairs?
Your Honor, I don't think that we can do that because I think it's exactly as Judge Lamon says. How does he know? You know, Judge Lamon says you needed to have an expert. How does Mr. McMahill know more than anyone exactly what that was? It could have been found that there was...
So the admission of a party's not qualified to discuss the value of his own property?
Well, that's what Judge Lamont's found, but I agree with you when you're saying property. I mean, I think the court is clear that if you want to say your house is valued at $250,000, the court has said a party can do that. But we're not talking the value of the property. We're talking about what is it going to cost to repair something. That's like looking at your car and saying, oh, yeah, the transmission's going. I think it's going to cost X. Well, until you get in there, until you're a professional and an expert, you have no idea what X really is. And I think that's what this was.
Well, lots of time you can say it's going to cost at least X. That's not out of bounds, is it?
No, you could do that.
So when, you know, Brian says at least $40,000, would it not be at least $40,000?
It was a stab in the dark. He had no idea. It was in his brain at some point they should be setting aside some amount of money to look at repairs on the roof.
You agree that that the trial court's intent was to split this a 50-50?
No, I do not. If you actually look at the ledger that's at the back, they're all round numbers. And I think as anybody who's gone through divorce cases knows that you got to pick just a number in time. And so that's what the court does. I mean, all of the, we stipulate to as many of the assets as possible, the values of the business, the value of River Park Plaza, the value of pensions, all of those were stopped at a certain moment. And so the court, you know, none of those were perfect. The court didn't say that you need to look at what the value was of the pensions on the date of final order. So I don't think so. I think that everything here was done in round numbers.
What's that got to do with 50-50? Excuse me, Judge.
Go ahead.
What's that got to do with the intent for 50-50?
I think the court was trying to get pretty close. But I don't think that it was like everything has to be exactly 50-50 because there were no numbers to be 50-50.
Ms. Lazar, I thought that Judge Lamon's figures that are attached to his ruling provided for an equalization payment so that the total result was a 50-50 division of marital property.
He did. He tried to come up with something that was as close to that as he could. It never works out to be 50-50, but I think that that's... he was trying to get close to that. I would agree with what the court has already brought up, is that this is really harmless error with a $7 million value on this property. The balancing says it's a harmless error being so small.
Is it harmless error, though, if the overriding intent of the judge is 50-50? You know, it's not just an equitable distribution, but the judge tries to set up a 50-50. And if there's recognizable $10,000 or $30,000 of error, isn't that deviating from the 50-50 controlling principle he was trying to exact?
You know, I think this goes back to something else that they keep saying, and that is that the court did reversible error because the court said that this cost was involved in the valuation. But if you really look at what the record says in the court, the order, when it was talking about Exhibit L and page 30, they were referring to the sprinkler system and redoing the apartment. The court never said that the cost of the roofs was taken out of the value. I think then you look at all the overall of what was going on here, and that the court found on numerous occasions that Ms. McMahill hadn't been honest with the court, hadn't been upfront with the court. So really, was there a need for the roof repair? I mean, just because Mr. McMahill had said, you know, we've been, you know, it's an old building, at some point we're going to need to do it, I'm thinking maybe it's going to be $40,000 someday. There was still no proof that was actually a roof needed to be repaired. It could have been a small hole that leaked. It could have been $200,000, I mean, $20,000 to fix it, or $5,000, or $20 to fix it. So there's no proof just because he said there was $40,000. And that's not what the court order says. It doesn't take out the cost of the roof because Ms. McMahill was the one who went up with the appraiser and told the appraiser there was no deferred maintenance on this. She personally met with him and did not disclose that it needed to have a new roof. So I think there was plenty of evidence before the court that there was that they hadn't proved that there needed to be a new roof. I hope that answers the question. I'm sorry. I guess they haven't brought up the argument of vagabond, the horse that's being owned by the, allegedly owned by the daughter, but I think the court can look at the intent of the parties over the years. This was the third horse that was allegedly in the children's names. The two previous ones had been purchased by the parents, insured by the parents. When those horses sold or had, one of them had to be put down for insurance, the money went back into the party's account. And that's the same thing that happened here, is this horse. There was no proof introduced that it was even in Jordan's name, but in the event that it was, Ms. McNahill testified that now Paige wanted to do it, and then Shay, when she got older, wanted to use the horse. The parties had paid for it, insured it, everything. No expenses came out of the children. And so I believe that the court should uphold that as well. I have nothing further unless there's any further questions, but I would request that the court affirm Judge Lammon's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. On the roof, the court on page 19 and 20 of its decree, CDs 252-253, talks about whether the roof and the sprinkler system were deducted from the appraisal. And this is the fourth line, third and fourth line on the top of page 253 of the CD. Therefore, the court finds that these costs were deducted from the initial appraisal and do not need to be reduced again. Well, they weren't deducted, so the court's finding is erroneous. I just want to mention Merle.
Well, before we go to Merle, how about back to the $40,000? You know, opposing counsel said $40,000 can't be taken as an admission, and essentially it can't be taken as any evidence of a roof repair because we don't know how to repair roofs. We don't know how much it costs.
Well, what he's saying, his testimony was, I budgeted $40,000, and that's a minimum. That was the minimum budget. I agree that Mr. McMahill's $40,000 is not a definitive figure. We needed a roofer, that was Mr. Nelson. But that's what they budgeted, that's what he estimated based upon whatever factors he estimated. But I think it is an admission that since he testified specifically and unequivocally it needed a new roof, the court found it needed a new roof, and he testified that he budgeted $40,000. I believe that's an admission. On Murrow, the undisputed testimony was this horse was owned 50% by the parties and 50% by a third party, Lance Shockley, and it was purchased for $40,000. So the party's interest was $20,000. And the testimony was the horse was lamed at the time of the trial, but there was no testimony as to what the value was at the time of trial. So even assuming the court assigned the original purchase price, which was $20,000, it would have been $10,000 per party to be equal, not the $20,000 which the court ordered Cindy to pay Brian. So again, based on the court's intent to divide everything equally, the court erred in imposing a $20,000 figure instead of a $10,000 figure. I see my time is up. I wanted to mention vagabond just briefly, but my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.